Chapter 4. When our company was disbanded, we had to take our rifles along with us. The instructions were to give them up on arrival at our hometown, so now we have come to the barracks and passed in our arms. At the same time, we received our demobilization pay, 50 marks discharge money per man, and 15 as sustenance allowance. In addition to that, we are entitled to one greatcoat, a pair of boots, a change of underclothes, and a uniform. We climb up to the top floor to take delivery of goods. The quartermaster makes a perfunctory gesture. Look something out for yourselves. Vili sets off on a hasty tour, nosing through all the things displayed. Listen here, you, he then says in parental fashion. You keep this for the recruits. This stuff came out of the Ark along with Noah. Show us something new. Haven't got any, retorts the quartermaster in a surly tone. Is that so? Says Vili, and considers a while. He brings out an aluminum cigar case. Smoke? The other shakes his bald pate. Chew, is it? Vili gropes in his tunic pocket. Nope. Good, then you drink? Vili has overlooked nothing. He feels toward a protuberance on his chest. Nor that either, replies the quartermaster offhand. Well, there's nothing for it but to swipe you a couple on the snout, explains Vili amiably. Anyway, we're not leaving here without a decent set of new togs, get me? Fortunately, at this moment, Yup appears, who, being a soldier's counselor, now carries some weight. He tips the quartermaster a wink. Pals of mine, Heinrich, old foot sloggers, show 'em into the salong, won't you? The quartermaster brightens up. Why couldn't they say so at first? We accompany him to a room at the back, and there the new things are hanging. We hastily discard our old gear and put on new. Vili submits that he needs two greatcoats, explaining that his blood has got very thin under the Prussians. The quartermaster hesitates. Yup takes him by the arm into a corner and has a talk with him about sustenance allowance. When the two return, the quartermaster is pacified. He casts an eye over Tjaden and Vili, who have grown noticeably stouter. Very good, he growls. It's all one to me. A lot of them don't even trouble to collect their stuff. Have enough brass of their own, I suppose. The main thing is my invoice must be in order. We sign that we have received everything. Didn't you say something about smoking a while back? Says the quartermaster to Vili. Vili is taken by surprise and produces his case with a grin. And chewing, the other persists. Vili turns out his tunic pocket. But you don't drink, I believe, essays Vili. On the contrary, says the quartermaster calmly. That's the one thing the doctor has ordered me. I'm a bit anemic myself, as a matter of fact. Just leave the bottle here, will you? Half a mo, says Vili, and takes a long pull at the flask, so that something, at least, may be reserved. Then he hands over a half-empty bottle to the astonished storeman. A moment ago, it was full. Yup accompanies us to the barracks gate. Guess who else is here, says he. Max Weil, on the soldiers' council. That's where he belongs, too, says Kozola. Nice soft job, I should say, eh?
Not so bad, answers Yup. Valentin and I are in the same line for the time being. If ever you want anything, railway passes or the like, I'm at the fountainhead, don't forget.
Give me a pass, then, I say, and I can go and see Adolf tomorrow.
He takes out a block and tears off a pass. Fill it in yourself. You travel second, of course.
Sure.
Outside, Vili unbuttons his greatcoat. There is another beneath it. It's better I should have it than that it should be sold off later by some swindler or other. And anyway, the Prussians owe it to me for my half-dozen shell splinters.
We set off down the high street. Cozzola is telling us that he proposes to repair his pigeon loft this afternoon. He used to breed carrier pigeons and black-and-white tumblers before the war, and is thinking of starting again now. That had been his one idea out at the front.
"And what then, Ferdinand?" I ask.
"Look for work," says he bluntly. "I'm a married man now, you know. Always got to keep the pot boiling now."
Suddenly, from the neighborhood of St. Mary's Church, comes a sound of shots. We listen.
"Rifles and service revolvers," says Villy professionally.
"Two revolvers, by the sound of it."
"Anyway,"
laughs Tiaden gaily, swinging his new boots by the laces.
"It's a bloody sight more peaceful than Flanders."
Villy stops short in front of a gentleman's outfitter's. In the window is exhibited a garment made out of paper and stinging nettle instead of cloth. But that interests him little. On the other hand, a row of faded fashion plates set out behind the suit of clothes holds him spellbound. He points excitedly to one picture of an elegant gentleman with a goatee beard, lost in eternal converse with a huntsman of sorts.
"Know what that is?"
"A shotgun," says Cozzola, looking at the sportsman.
"Rot,"
interrupts Villy impatiently.
"That's a cutaway, that is. A swallowtail, you know. Absolutely the latest thing. And do you know what's just occurred to me? I'll have one of them made for myself from this overcoat here. Take it to pieces, you see, and dye it black, remodel it, cut away the bottom part here. Bong, I tell you."
He is obviously in love with his idea. But Carl damps his ardor.
"Have you the striped trousers to go with it?" says he loftily.
Villy is nonplussed a moment.
"I know. I'll pinch the old man's," he decides at last. "And his white waistcoat for weddings as well. What will you think of Villy then, eh?"
Beaming with pleasure, he surveys the whole row of us.
"We'll see life yet, lads, eh? Damn it all."
I return home and give half of my demobilization pay to my mother.
"Ludwig Breyer's in there," says she. "He's waiting in your room."
"He's a lieutenant, too," adds my father.
"Yes," I reply. "Didn't you know?" "Ludwig seems rather better. His dysentery has improved."
"I just wanted to borrow some books from you, Ernst," he says and smiles at me.
"Take whatever you like, Ludwig," I say.
"Won't be wanting them yourself, then?" he asks.
I shake my head. "Not at the moment, anyway. I tried to read a bit only yesterday. But it's queer, you know. I don't seem to be able to concentrate properly anymore. By the time I've read two or three pages, I find I'm thinking of something else altogether. As if one were looking at a blank wall, you know?
But what is it you want? Novels?"
"No," says he, selecting a few books for himself. I glance at the titles.
"Heavy stuff, eh, Ludwig?" I say.
"What are you going to do with that?" He smiles, somewhat embarrassed. Then, hesitatingly, he says,
"Well, Ernst, you know, out there a lot of things would keep coming into my head, and I could never get the rights of them somehow. But now it's all over. There's a heap I'd like to understand. I'd like to know, for instance, what mankind is up to that such a thing could happen, and how it all came about. That raises a lot of questions. Questions for us, too. We had a very different notion of what manner of thing life was before, if you remember. There's a lot I'd like to know, Ernst."
I point to the books. "Think you'll find it in there?"
"I mean to try, anyway. I read from morning till night now."
He soon takes his leave, and I still sit on, lost in thought. What have I been doing all this time? With a feeling of shame, I reach for a book. But soon I have let it fall again and am gazing out the window. I can do that for hours together. Just look out into vacancy. It used to be different before. I always knew then what I would do. My mother comes into the room.
Ernst, you are going to Uncle Carl's tonight, aren't you?
Yes, I suppose so, I reply, rather disgruntled.
He has often sent us things to eat, she says prudently.
I nod. From the window I can see the twilight beginning outside. Blue shadows are lurking in the branches of the chestnuts. I turn around. Did you often go down by the poplars in the summertime, Mother? I ask suddenly. That must have been beautiful.
No, Ernst, not once all this year.
Why not, Mother? I ask in surprise. You used to go there every Sunday before.
We gave up going for walks altogether, she replies quietly. One is always so hungry afterwards. And you see, we had nothing to eat.
Ah, so, I say slowly. But Uncle Carl, he always had enough, I suppose?
He often sent us some too, Ernst.
All at once, I feel utterly dejected. What was the good of it all, Mother? I say. She strokes my hand.
It must have been for some good, Ernst. The Father in heaven knows. You may be sure of that.
Uncle Carl is the famous member of our family. He has a villa and was chief paymaster during the war. Wolf accompanies me to the house, but he must stay outside. My aunt dislikes dogs of any sort. I ring. An elegant man in a dress suit opens to me. Good evening, sir, I say, rather taken aback. Then it occurs to me he must be a domestic. I had quite forgotten such things in the army. The fellow looks me over as if he were a battalion commander in civvies. I smile, but he does not smile back. When I take off my greatcoat, he raises his hand as if to help me. Why, I say, to regain his favor. Surely an old soldier can do that much for himself, eh? And I hook my things up on a peg. Without a word, he takes them down again, and with a superior air, solemnly hangs them on a peg nearby. Poor worm, I think to myself, and pass in. Uncle Carl comes toward me, spurs clinking. He greets me condescendingly. I merely belong to the ranks. I look at his flashing regimentals in astonishment. What's on today? I ask, by way of making a joke. Roast horse? Horse? How do you mean horse? He asks, mystified. Well, wearing spurs to dinner, I reply, laughing. He gives me a sour look. Without meaning to, I seem to have touched a sore spot with him. It is often so with these army office pen pushers. They are prone to swords and spurs. Before I can explain to him that I meant no offense, my aunt comes up, rustling. She is still as she used to be, flat as an ironing board, and her little black eyes shining as ever, as though they had been newly polished on a button stick. While she is showering me with a flood of words, her quick eyes are glancing continually here, there, and everywhere about the room. I am rather embarrassed. Too many people for me, too many women, and worst of all, too much light. The most we ever had up the line was an oil lamp. But these chandeliers here, they are as merciless as bailiffs. One can hide nothing from them. I scratch my back uncomfortably. But what are you doing? says my aunt, interrupting her talk. Oh, it's probably just a louse that has escaped, I explain. We had so many of them, you know. It will take at least a week before a man's rid of them all. She steps back, horrified. Nothing to be frightened of, I reassure her. They don't hop. They're no fleas. For heaven's sake! She puts a finger to her lips and makes a face as if I had uttered God only knows what obscenity. But then they are like that. Heroes we may be, but one mustn't mention one word about lice. I have to shake hands with a lot of people and begin to perspire. The men here are quite different from us out there. I feel as cumbersome as a tank in comparison. They behave as if they were sitting in a shop window and talk as if they were on the stage. I try cautiously to hide my hands. The grime of the trenches is ground into them like poison. I dry them off surreptitiously on my trousers, but they are immediately wet again when I have to shake hands with a lady. I work my way around and come on a group where a chartered accountant is airing his views. Just think of it, he is saying, all worked up. A saddler, mind you, and president of the empire. Imagine it, a court levee and a saddler giving audience. It would make a cat laugh. He makes himself cough, he is so excited. What do you think about it, my young warrior? He says, patting me on the shoulder. As a matter of fact, I have never given the matter a thought. I shrug my shoulders doubtfully. Perhaps he knows a thing. The accountant looks at me fixedly a moment. Then he chuckles. I should say he does know a thing or two. No, no, my young friend. These things are inborn. A saddler. If so, then why not a tailor? Or a cobbler, even? He turns again to the others. I dislike his talk. It goes against my grain to hear him speak so contemptuously of cobblers. They make as good soldiers as the finer folk, anyway. Adolf Bethke was a cobbler, for that matter, and he knew a sight more about war than a good many majors. It was the man that counted with us, not his occupation. I eye the accountant dispraisingly. He's throwing about quotations now, and it may well be that he has ladled in culture with a spoon. But if it ever came to that again, and someone had to bring me in under fire, I would sooner put my trust in Adolf Bethke. I am glad when at last we sit down to table. Beside me is a young girl with a swan's down boa around her neck. I like the look of her, but have not the faintest idea what I should talk to her about. As a soldier, one did not talk much, and to ladies, not at all. The others are conversing freely, so I try to listen in the hope of picking up an idea or two. Farther up the table, the accountant has just been explaining how, if only we had held out a bit longer, the war would have been won. Such bilge makes me almost sick. Any soldier knows that we had no more munitions and no more men. That's all there is about it. Opposite him is a woman talking about her husband who was killed, and from the way she goes on, one might think it was she had been killed and not he. Lower down, they are talking about securities and peace terms, and all of them, of course, know much better what should be done than the people who actually have to deal with the matter. A fellow with a hook nose is talking scandal about the wife of a friend of his, but with an air of such sanctimonious sham sympathy, I should like to pitch my beer into his face as a reward for such ill-concealed malice. All the talk makes me stupid in the head, and I am soon quite unable to follow any longer. The girl with the swan boa asks scornfully whether I became dumb out at the front. Not entirely, I answer, and think to myself, I only wish Kozola and Tjaden could sit here among you. How they would laugh to hear the flap-doodle you peddle and so pride yourselves on. All the same, it riles me not to be able to show them in one telling thrust what I think. It would not rile Cozzola, though. He would know well enough what to say. It would be pat and to the point. At this moment, God be praised, crisp grilled chops appear on the table. I sniff. Real pork chops they are, fried in real fat, too. The sight of them consoles me for all the rest. I lean over and secure a good one and begin chewing with relish. It tastes marvelous. It's a power of time since I last ate a fresh chop. In Flanders, it was. We bagged a couple of suckling pigs. We ate them down to the very ribs one lovely, mild summer evening. Kaczynski was alive then. Ah, Kat. Datering. A sight better they were than these fellows at home here. I prop my elbows on the table and forget everything around me, so clearly do I see them before me. Such tender little beasts, too. We made potato cakes to go with them. And Krop was there, and Paul Boehmer. Yes, Paul. I neither hear nor see anything now. I lose myself in memories. A giggle awakes me. About the table is dead silence. Aunt Lena has a face like a bottle of vitriol. The girl beside me is stifling a laugh. Everybody is looking at me. Sweat breaks out on me in streams. There I sit, just as we did then out in Flanders, absent-minded, both elbows on the table, the bone in my two hands, my fingers covered in grease, gnawing off the last scraps of the chop. But the others are eating cleanly with knife and with fork. Red as a beetroot, I look straight ahead and put down the bone. How could I so have forgotten myself? But to tell the truth, I hardly know now how else to go about it. We always ate that way at the front. At the best of times, we had only a spoon or a fork, certainly never a plate. But there is anger, too, in my embarrassment. Anger against this Uncle Carl, now beginning to talk so loudly of war loans. Anger against all these people here that think so much of themselves and their smart talk. Anger against this whole world, living here so damned cocksure with their knick-knacks and jiggery-pokery, as though the monstrous years had never been when one thing and one thing only mattered, life or death, and beyond that, nothing. Grimly, in silence, I stuff in all I can. I mean at least to be full. Then, as soon as I can, I make my way out. In the lobby is the servant in the dress suit. I reach down my things. We should have had you up the line too, you lacquered ape, I spit. You and the whole bunch here. Then I slam to the door. Wolf has waited for me outside the house. He leaps up on me. Come, Wolf, I say, and suddenly know that it was not the affair with the chop that made me feel so bitter, but the fact that the same vapid, self-satisfied spirit as of old should still be lording it here and giving itself airs. Come, Wolf, I repeat. Those are not our sort. We would get along better with any Tommy, with any front-line froggy than with them. Come, let's go to our pals. It's better there, even if they do belch and eat with their hands. Come. We trot along, the dog and I. We run as hard as we can, faster and faster, panting, barking. We run like mad, with shining eyes. To hell with them all. But we live, eh, Wolf? We live.